Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Stable, predictable funding is key to improving student outcomes by stabilizing schools and reducing turnover.
In the debate over boosting education funding, some calls for a longer-term plan. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 25th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, how Anchorage Library employees recorded inflammatory comments by their well-connected conservative boss.
What the employees told me was it was a combination of being afraid that people wouldn't believe what she was saying, but maybe more so that nothing would be done about it.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by SNAP.
School districts are waiting anxiously to see if the Alaska legislature will increase school funding after years of stagnant state support. The recently passed House budget includes a one-time boost that Kenai district officials say would solve this year's budget shortfall, but won't save the district from long-term struggles. KDLL's Riley Board reports.
This spring, lawmakers in Juneau have heard hours and hours of testimony about issues related to school funding. From educators like Jenna Fabian, the principal at Nikiski North Star Elementary School.
As a building principal, I have spent a lot of sleepless nights worrying about burnout and our educators leaving the profession. I'm even more worried about whether or not we will have qualified candidates for those vacancies.
Fabian is part of a chorus of voices advocating for more funding for Alaska schools as districts statewide struggle with budgets that have fallen behind inflation. The Alaska legislature is considering multiple options. On one side, the House of Representatives is considering a temporary fix. It passed a budget last Monday that includes a $175 million one-year boost to in-state funding for K-12 public schools. That's about a 15% increase, equivalent to a $680 increase in the state's per-student funding formula. But the budget will still need to go through the Senate and governor before it's finalized. The topic of education funding has been at the forefront of the legislature this session and in the Kenai Peninsula Borough and School District. The district has been projecting a $13 million deficit for the next school year and approved pool closures, cuts to theater staff, and changes in the teacher-student ratio to make up the gap. The district, like many around the state, is counting on a boost from the legislature to avoid having to follow through on those cuts.
We are continually asked to do more, and we're doing more with less every year.
That's District Board of Education member Zen Kelly, who also serves as chair of the Finance Committee. He says the one-time funding boost in the House budget is a good temporary measure, but won't solve long-term woes.
We will be in the same situation next year of dealing with not knowing what our allocation is from the state when we start drafting our budget in October for the following year.
The Senate is considering a longer-term solution. Representatives from the borough and school district have been strong advocates for an increase to the BSA, or base student allocation, the amount school districts get from the state per student. The borough assembly unanimously passed a resolution asking the legislature for what it called a meaningful increase to the BSA in March. Still, the proposal has generated a lot of discussion and confusion. The Kenai City Council had a fraught conversation about a similar resolution earlier this month and ultimately killed it. Over the past couple weeks, the Senate Finance Committee heard public testimony on a Senate bill that would increase the BSA by $1,000 this year, an additional $350 next year, and create an inflation-based increase the following year. The vast majority of those testifying in Senate Finance urged passage of a BSA increase, and many asked for sustained increases going forward. 4 members of the Kenai District's Board of Education testified, and others still were queued up to speak but cut for time. One person who spoke was Board President Debbie Carey.
Without an increase, KPBSD is looking at cutting 34 positions. Supporting Senate Bill 52 will not only allow districts to reduce their deficit, but will also allow districts to fulfill their goals and strategic plans.
Fabian, the Nikiski principal, also showed support for a sustained, inflation-proofed BSA.
Stable, predictable funding is key to improving student outcomes by stabilizing schools and reducing turnover.
Kelly says that turnover is a key reason the district is so desperate for sustained BSA increases. Among the 34 positions the district may have to cut, 11 are teaching positions. Kelly says the district needs to know whether it can renew those contracts by the end of the school year next month. Kelly says they'll be the first priority once the legislature settles on a number.
It's so hard right now to find quality teachers. And so that's our biggest impact. And it'll be what I, as finance chair, will push the board to do first, as soon as we have knowledge of any increase at all, is to retain those certified positions.
Then the district's finance committee will decide on what else to bring back into the budget, depending on what that legislative boost looks like. In addition to pools and theater techs, the district has approved cuts to athletic directors, student success liaisons, and extracurricular travel funds.
There is still time to save these programs. There is still time to keep our pools and our theaters open, to reinstitute the reductions that we made in staffing at our high schools and middle schools. There is still time to save this. But we can't stop letting the legislature know how important it is.
Action on the budget is now in the Senate. The two chambers need to reach a compromise before May 17th, when the Constitution requires the legislature to adjourn. In Juneau, I'm Riley Board.
Alaska's governor and the mayor of the state's largest city have continued to support a controversial conservative ally despite her history of racist, homophobic, and transphobic comments. The inflammatory remarks from Anchorage's Deputy Library Director Judy Ellidge were most recently documented in a story by the Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica that included audio secretly recorded by one of Ellidge's subordinates. In the recordings, Ellidge calls Alaska Native people, quote, woke and racists, and transgender people, quote, very troubled. And when library employees complained about Ellidge to city and state agencies tasked with investigating discrimination, the complaints were either ignored or became mired in a backlog caused by understaffing. Anchorage Daily News reporter Kyle Hopkins wrote the recent story about Ellidge, a former teacher, head of the Anchorage Republican Women's Club, and a major player in Alaska's conservative political scene.
Yeah, if you rewind back to 2021, there's the city elections. There's this group of conservative candidates who are looking to win election as a group to the school board. And immediately, there's opposition research on both sides, and people are looking for dirt on their opponents. Screenshots of Judy's Facebook posts were being shared. There were stories being written about them. And for example, there was the one where she said, I don't want to try and quote it, but it had to do with, people of color having low self-esteem.
She was not elected to school board and then got appointed as the kind of second in command at the library, but was because a library director was never confirmed. She was basically in charge of the library. And then, I mean, she hadn't even really been on the job that long before there were accusations of other sort of racist, maybe homophobic things that she had said in the workplace that employees at the library started raising red flags about and going to different offices to try to report that. And what happened with that?
What I heard from library employees was that, she was not shy about sharing her beliefs, right? And so employees would say, if not their first encounter with Ellidge, it would be within the first days of kind of meeting her, that she would kind of lay out her, her views, right? Which involved, that she was there to kind of stamp out woke culture, that the library was too woke, that there were too many women choosing the books, that she did not believe in this idea of equity, that she had problems with plans. She'd found that there were plans to kind of redo the Alaska Room and kind of recenter the Alaska Room on more of like an indigenous historical account rather than like a white centered or like colonial account. And she, and she would talk about like, that's not happening. That's not happening until a different mayor comes in, because, she made it clear that the mayor hired her to kind of stop that type of behavior. And there were multiple employees recording her. she would come in their office and she would say these things that seemed like our HR, at least to them, to be like maybe HR violations. And they would make the record, you know, they just would record it in order to have kind of proof of what was being said.
So this was, like you said, they were trying to have proof that she actually said the things that she said.
Yeah. What the employees told me was it was a combination of being afraid that people wouldn't believe what she was saying, but maybe more so that nothing would be done about it, you know, because you had another ally of the mayor, Nikki Shabaka, who at the time was the head of HR. And so when they would go to HR, what they said and what is being reflected in, you know, lawsuits and complaints to the city and threats of lawsuits is that when they went to HR, HR said, yeah, tough luck. Sorry. You know, at first the response was, all right, we need people to officially complain. Then you have the head of HR like wearing a T-shirt that says I'm with Judy at the advisory board meeting. And so, you know, what message does that send to library employees? It's certainly not that HR is going to want to hear your complaints about Judy Elledge.
Right. But there was somewhere else that they could take these complaints theoretically. And who was that and what happened?
So a few weeks ago, I wrote a story about the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights and how they had quietly changed positions on what types of anti-LGBTQ complaints they would investigate. Basically, they had stopped investigating most categories of LGBTQ complaints on the advice of Dunleavy's Attorney General, Craig Taylor. And I think one of the most kind of newsworthy elements was this encounter that one of the library employees had when they are talking to an investigator for the state commission who says, in a recording, says, well, the LGBTQ stuff, which is some of the stuff that Elledge is talking about, we've been told that not to investigate most categories there. So that's kind of a non-starter. And it's a sensitive issue for the governor. And, you know, this is the investigator saying, we just recently got a valid complaint from the city that we turned away for the, you know, for political reasons because of the political implication for the governor.
And so, I mean, as these stories have come out over the years about the things that she's said, have you gotten any indication of why either the governor or the mayor still hold her so closely despite all of that?
First of all, Dunleavy and Bronson won't do interviews. They just won't. They won't talk to you in person about this stuff. Even if you kind of catch them somewhere, they just won't talk. And so, you know, we send in the questions and then got a statement from the mayor's office saying, you know, they can't comment because of this pending lawsuit, which, you know, that's fair. But a lot of what we were asking about had nothing to do with the lawsuit. It had to do with like her history of social media, the mayor's relationship to her, their fundraising relationship. And so the mayor makes a statement through his spokesperson that says, you know, we can't comment, but we kind of denounce, you know, discriminatory talk. And so that was this response from Bronson. But he has at an assembly meeting saying, look, this is someone who I've known for 25 years. She has my unquestioned support. You know, I mean, Governor Dunleavy is someone who he had a fundraiser co-hosted by Judy Elledge. She's standing next to him when he won the state Republican primary. You know, she's been clear that they're close friends. They have a kind of a long political relationship. In a State of the State speech, he was saying, look, this is someone who exemplifies the heart of Alaska, right? And he's pretty steadfast about not answering questions about what's the nature of that relationship. Does he does it play a role in, you know, his decisions to appoint her to a national commission? So long story short, he's not answering questions about her.
That was Anchorage Daily News reporter Kyle Hopkins. You can find his full story about Anchorage Deputy Library Director Judy Elledge written in conjunction with ProPublica at ADN.com. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Hune Lance Twitchell is among those working to preserve Alaska Native languages.
Give yourself an affirmation, and that affirmation is this. No language dies on my watch.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
In rural Alaska communities, village public safety officers make a difference every day. Hired regionally, VPSOs are trained in public safety services such as community policing, fire prevention, life-saving emergency medical response, and search and rescue. VPSO receive competitive pay, benefits, and opportunities for advancement. To start your career in public safety and learn more about becoming a VPSO, go to vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by VPSO.
Indigenous people in Alaska are murdered and go missing at higher rates than almost anywhere in the country. Vivian Corthia sits on a commission created by Congress to address the problem. She says more than 300 Alaska Natives are on the missing and murdered registry.
To me, that's the same size of a village, a whole village. And it's shocking to know that there's that many people were missing.
The Not Invisible Commission met in Anchorage today to hear testimony from victims and from advocates working to prevent violence. They identified a range of problems, including a lack of services for vulnerable people and too little law enforcement in rural Alaska. Systemic racism and trauma were recurring themes. Several advocates told the commission that it's hard to make federal programs work in rural Alaska, especially for small tribes. Dana Deal, Director of Wellness and Prevention at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, said federal grants are not easily tailored to community needs.
Oftentimes the scope of our funding is very limited and narrow, but from an Alaska Native perspective, we see things more holistically, and you can't separate things like mental health, physical health, and spiritual health.
The commission invited family members of missing and murdered Indigenous people to testify during an afternoon session that was closed to the media. By October, the panel is supposed to produce recommendations on how the federal government can prevent and respond to violence against Native Americans and Alaska Natives. The Anchorage hearing continues tomorrow. Western Alaska Chum versus Eastern Aleutian Sockeye. That's how many people are framing an Alaska Senate bill that aims to temporarily close Area M, a fishery off the Alaska Peninsula and Eastern Aleutian Islands. The Senate Judiciary Committee met Friday to hear testimony on a bill that would close June commercial salmon fishing there. Supporters of the bill say Area M's commercial fleet intercepts Chum and Chinook salmon. They say that's contributed to dismal returns to Bristol Bay and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Salmon runs to the Delta have been so low in recent years that entire villages are struggling to catch enough fish for their communities. Democratic Senator Donnie Olson of Golovin sponsored the bill. His staffer, Almeria Alcantara, told the committee that temporarily closing Area M would give Chum and Chinook salmon a better chance of returning to their spawning grounds and stave off ecological collapse.
This collapse has led to fishery closures along the rivers and their tributaries for all fishing types, which has had a severe impact to the subsistence and personal use harvests that residents rely on for their cultural, financial, and physical well-being.
But support during the committee meeting was mixed. While dozens of people spoke out in favor of the bill, many also spoke against it. Charlotte Levy is the Natural Resources Assistant Director for the Eastern Aleutian Borough, which is at the center of Area M. She told the committee the bill would unfairly hurt local fishermen in her region's small fishing communities.
The closure of this fishery essentially seeks to value the lives of some Alaskans over others. These are under 60-foot small boat fleets. These are subsistence users.
The bill is currently in committee with the Alaska Senate. If approved, the bill would still need to find support in the House. About 28% of registered Anchorage voters cast a ballot in the spring election. It's the lowest voter turnout since the city moved to by-mail voting. But as Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, election officials say it's still higher than in years before the change.
Historically, Anchorage voter turnout has been all over the place. The highest years were in the 80s. Three elections had more than 50% turnout. Then by 2010, turnout plummeted to less than 20%, and Municipal Clerk Barbara Jones says local politicos started taking notice.
In 2015 and 16, former Assembly Member Ernie Hall was concerned about voter turnout. And he asked the clerk's office to look into what we could do to increase voter turnout.
Enter mail-in elections. After multiple public meetings, the city made the switch as a way to boost turnout. The first by-mail election was held in 2018, and turnout topped 36%, the highest in 20 years. Every year since has had turnout above 25%, including this year, a non-mayoral election.
I do think that voter turnout has increased, so Ernie Hall's experiment was successful.
Election officials say vote-by-mail is not not only better for turnout, but relies on fewer staff, provides more flexibility for voters, and ends up being cheaper. Elections clerk Jamie Hines says the first by-mail election in 2010 did cost double as the city acquired a new election center and equipment to scan and tabulate votes. But now the price has dropped significantly.
So now that we are using that over and over and year over year over year, the costs are going down. The cost per voter is less.
Before mail-in voting, the city's cost per voter was between $9 and $11. Now the figure is down to just under $8. The number of election staff required is also way smaller, down from 600 to 60. Still, the mail-in system is not without its detractors. Some question how secure the system is, with some voters reporting that they've received other people's ballots in the mail. Hines says even if somebody does try to vote with another person's ballot, there are parameters in place to prevent it from being counted.
What stops it from being counted is that that signature isn't going to match. We get five signatures from the state, and we have a team of five people who do signature verification. They're trained by forensic document examiners, and they're trained to look for characteristics of signatures.
Hines says there could also be criminal consequences if someone tries voting with someone else's ballot.
There were, I think, six situations, and APD did go knock on their doors. And we think most of the time it was a clear misunderstanding of the laws, but I think they understand it quite well now.
Jones invites residents who may be skeptical about the mail-in process to come to the downtown voting center. If they can't make it, there's a 24-hour live stream during elections. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Construction season is here, Alaska. Avoid surprises on the drive. Before getting on your way, check 511 for traffic delays. For current traffic information and road conditions, visit 511.alaska.gov or download the app, or call 511. For more detailed information about DOT construction projects, visit dot.alaska.gov/construction. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
With winter conditions extending into late April, a longtime Upper Yukon River resident is concerned about the potential for ice jams in Eagle during breakup.
All in all, an extremely rare year out here. Very late conditions. It feels like early March or late February right now.
Andy Basich tracks ice and snow levels and says this spring's numbers stand out.
About 39 inches of ice. Normally this time of year, I would see 20 to 24 inches of ice, so thicker ice. Snow cover is currently 24 to 30 inches on the river. Normally, we at this time of year, we'd see little to no snow on the river. The ice when drilling is still solid. It's hard ice. It's not soft.
Thick ice and heavy snow can lead to ice jam flooding if there's an abrupt warm-up. Basich also describes unusually rough ice, which formed when the river froze last fall.
We had a very high freeze-up with heavy jumble ice, basically from Dawson City in the Yukon Territory all the way to Circle. And then as the winter went on, the ice continued to drop steadily. And now we're at a pretty low compared to other years. So it probably won't take as much water to get the ice moving. But being low like that, it's very possible that we'll see a lot of jamming.
Basich says the situation is different than in 2009 when the river ice level was high and the Eagle area suffered a catastrophic ice jam flood. He expects this year's Eagle area breakup to be later than normal, likely sometime between May 12th and 15th, but adds that a big warm-up could accelerate things. Alaska Native language experts shared their personal stories at the state capitol on Friday. They were there to give an update on the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, they also hoped to inspire those at the highest levels of government to support Indigenous languages.
Dr. Waukee Charles told a gathering of lawmakers and their staffers that at the age of 12, he was taken away from his home in Ammonic and sent to a boarding school. He said his mother only spoke the Yupik language, or Yuktun, and didn't understand what happened to him.
My mother just recently, she died 9 years ago, finally told me that every time she heard a plane approaching to our village, that once a week, she was hoping I would be in that plane returning home, but I never did.
Charles said he was also ripped away from his heart language and didn't reconnect to it until he was in college. 2 years ago, Charles became the first Native director of the Alaska Native Language Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Yayuk Bernadette Alvana Stimpfel, an Inupiaq language leader, recalled what she felt as a child.
I could remember being a non-English speaker at 5 years old, making us to sing this song, "I'm a little teapot, short and stout." In my five-year-old Inupiaq mind, say niungilanga, I am not a teapot.
So Alaska for a long time had been on a path of decided elimination of indigenous languages. Right? There was intention, there was purpose, there was a well-orchestrated attack on our peoples.
Hune Lance Twitchell told the group that there are 23 Alaska Native languages, and a few of those are no longer spoken.
We don't like the word extinct. We prefer dormant, because we've seen languages come back.
Hune says with only 30 fluent speakers of Tlingit, it hasn't been easy to rescue his language, but it is possible.
Imagine if you could, if the English language went three generations without creating a single new speaker. Then imagine if you could, watching a child sit down at a table full of elders who could then speak to that child, and that child understands them.
Hune says those elders had lived through a 70-year gap without hearing any new speakers of their language.
We didn't tell her to. She just went and sat with the elders. And they were laughing, and I could just see the sparkle in their eyes to see a child who can understand them.
In his work as head of the Native Language Program at the University of Alaska Southeast, Hune has helped to create a new generation of Tlingit speakers. He says those who work at the state capitol also have an important part to play.
Everybody who works in this building for the people, that when you walk through those doors every day, maybe you could just give yourself an affirmation. And that affirmation is this: no language dies on my watch. No language dies on my watch.
And the legislature definitely bears some responsibility in this, because back in 2012, it created the Language Preservation Council that Hune now chairs. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And finally tonight, a correction to a story last night about a statewide sales tax which misstated the title of economist Nolan Clauda. He is the director of the University of Alaska Anchorage's Center for Economic Development. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Riley Board in Juneau, Liz Ruskin, Wesley Early, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Theo Greenlee in Unalaska, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.